Welcome to this new seminar. Our speaker today is Dominique Ricas from the University of Cologne. Dominique graduated at the Heidelberg, actually as a student of the Max Planck Research Institute for Astronomy. Then he moved to Caltech the first 3 years as a Hubble Fellow, and then continued for the next 2 years and 5 years in total as senior research as a senior research fellow. Again, at Caltech. He appointed as assistant professor at the University of Cornell University until getting the professorship at the University of Cologne a couple of years ago, 1 year ago, roughly. So today he'll talk about this very recent paper published on Nature, years ago, let's say. I invite everyone to interrupt him at any time, hopefully open the webcam and ask at any time. So please, Dominique, it's up to you. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, please go ahead and just ask questions because I can't see the chat. So just unmute yourself and ask whenever you have questions. Yeah, so thanks for the nice introduction. So what I'm going to talk about today is this paper on the measurement of the cosmic microwave background temperature at a redshift of slightly beyond 6. From water absorption. And since the main gist of this is essentially the measurement of the CMB temperature, of course, the first question that you might ask yourself, and maybe even should ask yourself, is why is this something that we're interested in doing? Is this not something that's rather trivial? Because, of course, in standard Lambda CDM cosmology, the redshift scaling of the CMB temperature is simply the CMB temperature at present day times 1 plus the redshift. So if we live in Lambda CDM cosmology, then in principle, this question is already answered. However, the thing is that the assumption that goes into this is really not trivial because we don't, strictly speaking, know that our cosmology is as simple as kind of our standard model that we have at the moment. And this particular redshift scaling can be altered by different effects. And one possibility is, for example, that if you have evolving physical constants, this relation can change. If you have some sort of coupling processes like axion photon-like coupling processes, this can change. And also for decaying dark energy models, this can change. So there's different theories that are out there that might actually modify this behavior that would be difficult to see in other kinds of measurements. So really, it's worth to do experimental tests to really figure out that this redshift scaling is the way that we expect it to be. And the way that we try to do this in general is what's shown here is that in that we try to test deviations from a sort of cosmological constant behavior of dark energy, which means dark energy doesn't change as a function of time, through this particular parameterization here of this equation that I've shown you first. And I'm not going to go through deviation of this. If you're interested in this here, I'm giving you a reference and you can look at how this looks. But instead, I'm going to just talk about the different factors that go into this that are interesting to figure out what's going on. So you can see that the first factor that goes into this extra term that we see here is omega matter zero, which is just the present day baryonic plus dark matter density parameter that's important for this. And for this study, we've just fixed this to the value that has been measured from Planck at about 0.32. The second factor that you can see here is in this exponent, this factor gamma, and gamma is the adiabatic index for matter and radiation. And just to remind you what this is, so the adiabatic index is essentially this index that you get in the equation of state between pressure and density. And for radiation matter, this is then that the pressure is gamma minus one times the density. And in standard cosmology, this is just a factor of 4/3. And therefore, if you look at the dark at the equation of state parameter for matter and radiation, W, which is then the entire prefactor here, this then comes out to be 1/3 for the relativistic contribution from the radiation term. Therefore, this is essentially the expectation value that we have in standard cosmology. And then the next factor that's important is this factor M that you see appear here in different places. And this factor M is related to the dark energy station of equation of state parameter WDE. And essentially WDE, of course, is in the same kind of definition, just the ratio between the pressure of dark energy and the density of dark energy. And then this m factor is parameterized that w is just m thirds minus one for the dark energy equation of state parameter. And for cosmological constant, as a reminder, the dark energy equation of state parameter is just minus one, which means that m simply is null, is zero for a cosmological constant. So in principle, these are the factors that go into this, in particular gamma and w dark energy is the factors that we can therefore constrain by measuring the redshift scaling behavior of the CMB temperature. All right, but how do we do this in practice? So in principle, we can constrain the CMB temperature from the CMB itself, but then also, as we're going to see, there's different, we can look at this at different redshifts by looking at actual distortions to the CMB. And of course, one thing that we've discovered is as we got better and better measurements of the CMB, as I indicated here, is that if you go to higher and higher resolution, that essentially we still see the CMB and we see it at ever increasing resolution. But then eventually, we, as we reach high enough resolution, we see that superposed on the CMB, there are several point sources, both in emission and in absorption, on top of the CMB in the highest quality CMB data that we have. And then, of course, we know that these emission sources typically either are radio galaxies or quasars. So essentially, you see the tailing of these radio sources in the millimeter regime, or they are dusty galaxies or the so-called cosmic infrared background that also cause emission due to dust in individual high redshift galaxies. And the CIB, again, is, of course, this component here in the infrared wavelength shortboard of the CMB. And then you can see this overlapping region here, where you can see that there can be significant contribution at the wavelengths where the CMB is still strong in the millimeter regime. And these are the sources that we're seeing. But then in addition to this, there's also absorption sources that shows absorption against the CMB. And this, of course, is due to the galaxy cluster Zinnias-Zeldovich effect. And here's just an example of different galaxy clusters, in this case from the ACT survey, that show us what this looks like. So essentially, we see these absorption sources imprinted on the CMB at this high resolution. All right, so just for those of you that might not remember, what is the SZ effect is? So the SZ effect is something that we can measure due to the fact that the CMB photons, as they enter galaxy clusters, can get inverse Compton scattered by the hot plasma that's associated with the galaxy clusters, because they're simply inverse Compton scatter off the high energy free electrons. And what therefore happens is that they get an increase or a bump in energy at the position of the galaxy cluster. So was there a question? Okay. Yeah, so the way that this looks like is what's shown here. So across the entire sky, we have the CMB spectrum that's shown here in red, but then at the position of the galaxy cluster, what happens is that you get this energy bump towards higher frequencies. And therefore you see this blue spectrum here due to the SZ effect. And what this means is that at the position of the galaxy clusters, you can then take the difference to the CMB and see that compared to the CMB, you see at this long wavelengths here, from the long millimeter to the centimeter regime, you get a deficit and therefore an absorption signal. Then at about 1.5 millimeter, you see essentially the same things that you expect, and therefore you see zero signal. And then at the highest frequencies, you see an emission signal. And that's what's also depicted as the curve here. So in principle, this is a signal that we see then imprinted on the CMB due to this effect associated with galaxy clusters. And as we think about measuring the CMB temperature, this is really kind of the most classical and direct way that we can then measure the CMB temperature at different redshift due to the SZ effect. And of course, the idea here is that the amount of energy change that we are seeing depends on the CMB photon energy itself. And assuming that we know the electrokinetic energy or the temperature of the intercluster medium, essentially we can use this to gain a constraint on the CMB temperature. And that's what's shown in this graph. So what I'm showing you here is the CMB temperature as a function of redshift. And then the different symbols here are first in green, the present day measurement from COBE of the CMB temperature. But then in the different colors here, we see different samples of clusters from Planck. And the SZ survey in this case, auto redshift of one or so, where we see this increase here of the CMB temperature with redshift. And then this here is a zoom in to this region. And then also what I've done here is essentially divide out the expected redshift scaling. So I've divided the CMB temperature by one plus the redshift. So we can see how it behaves compared to our expectation. And what you can see here is that auto redshift of 0.3 or 0.4 or so, we get quite precise measurements of this, but then auto redshift of 1 or so, we still get good constraints, but with increasingly large uncertainties from the SC effect. Now, the problem, of course, is that by redshift of 1, we start to run out of sufficiently massive clusters that we don't have these large enough cluster sums anymore to do this measurement as reliably, and therefore, currently, the SC-based measurements are restricted mostly to redshifts between 0 and 1. And I should also emphasize that essentially what's shown here is kind of this fitting function on slide 2 that I've I've indicated there. Okay, how can we then do this at higher redshift? So it turns out that higher redshift, we can gain at least some indirect constraints on the CMB temperature by looking at QSO absorption line systems at ultraviolet wavelengths. And that's what's shown here now as these red symbols. So the idea is that we can use these absorption line systems along the lines of sight of quasars to measure either the COM carbon monoxide lines in the electronic bands in the UV, or also the C1 or C2 lines. And then by looking at these absorption lines in the UV, we can also constrain the CMB temperature because we can essentially use the excitation temperature of these transitions as an approximation for the CMB temperature. Now, what we need to keep in mind here is that this is not a direct absorption into the CMB, but just into the quasar continuum emission. Another uncertainty in this is that the temperature that we get out depends on the excitation of the CO itself. And therefore, I've mentioned that's an indirect measurement, and it's something that has a systematic uncertainty due to assumptions that we make about the CO excitation. And that's kind of illustrated here again in the zoom in. So what I'm showing here is the different colored symbols is the same absorption line systems, but essentially three different assumptions for the CO excitation, where you can see that you get this scatter towards lower values depending on what assumption you make. And this again is due to the fact that you use the excitation temperature of the CO as a proxy for the measurement, and therefore you're sensitive to the excitation of the CO itself. Okay, but then with these measurements, you can essentially get constraints auto redshift of 3 or so based on the absorption aligned systems. And this is pretty much what we could do in the past. So the way in which method differs that we are describing in this paper and that I'm going to describe here now is that we're using a different kind of signal to constrain the CMB temperature directly out to even higher redshifts. And what we're using here is essentially a spectral distortion to the cosmic microwave background that's due to sources from the cosmic infrared background. So again, from this peak here in the overall sky brightness spectrum. And what I'm showing you here is an overall sky mag of the cosmic infrared background. But what I'm going to focus on is an individual galaxy that's in this field here, the so-called FLS field. And I'm showing you here this field about 7 square degrees in size with measurements from the Herschel telescope between 250 and 500 micron. And then this individual source in this field is down here. And here I'm showing you again the different bands and the color of the source so you can see how it sticks out. And then this here is again a zoom in just to the Herschel source itself, which is now this bright red blob here. And then the center of this blob, you can see then with interferometers at higher spatial resolution, the source that sits in the middle of this. And this is a galaxy that we call HFLS3 in the following. And you can see that this galaxy has an extent of less than an arcsecond on the sky. So it's really a small scale distortion that we're talking about here. I'm showing you this here in the dust continuum and the 158 micron SD plus line of this source. So the galaxy itself, we discovered already a couple of years ago, and this is the original discovery spectrum that we got for the galaxy. And the important part here is that we see here the increasing slope of the dust continuum emission in this galaxy. And then superposed on this, we see all of this molecular and atomic fine structure lines that shows us that at this high redshift, this galaxy is already highly enriched. And again, we're talking here about an epoch about 880 million years after the Big Bang. So this is a high redshift galaxy, and indeed the highest redshift of these dusty starburst galaxies that has been known at the time. And of course, these spectral lines here are a very valuable tool to understand the physical conditions for star formation in the most distant galaxies. I'm giving here also some additional parameters of the galaxy itself that we can derive from all of these measurements that we do. But as we're going to see in the following, there actually is more to it that we can do with these lines. Okay, what I'm showing you here now is here, and zoom into this region here at in the observed frame 3 millimeter band that shows you the original spectrum that we got for this galaxy, which led to its redshift identification. And this is a spectrum that we took in about 80 hours with a Kalman interferometer at the time to identify the redshift of this galaxy. However, more recently, we went back then to the Noema interferometer after its major upgrade and took another spectrum for about 30 hours. And here you can see for comparison, the increase in quality that we can now get a couple of years later due to the increase that we have in technology to do these kinds of measurements. And you can see here the spectrum that we have now of this galaxy. And here I'm just showing you the spectrum again, where you can see these multiple bright lines from CO and then water and also the C1 line here, multiple fainter features, and again, the dust continuum. And in principle, there's again, of course, a lot of interesting studies that we can do of the galaxy with this spectrum. But what I'm going to talk about today is just this one line that's shown here in this red box that seems to be different from all of the other lines, because as you can see, first, that it's an absorption line. But also you can see that it's not just an absorption line, but actually it's an absorption line that's stronger than the galaxy continuum itself. And the line is shown here again in the zoom in, and you can see that the strength of the absorption line is about twice the strength of the continuum emission of the galaxy, which means that the absorption is stronger than the continuum emission of this galaxy. So the question is now, how can we explain this? So essentially what you can see is that there's zero flux indicated. Kind of on this scale, it seems that this is a line with a negative flux. And the question is, how can we understand that a line can have a negative flux? So the idea here is that, of course, in the millimeter wavelengths where this where these emission lines are measured, the sky itself is not empty, but it actually is filled with the cosmic microwave background. But due to the fact that we do measurements with the interferometer itself is essentially blind to the large scale CMB emission. And therefore, if you just point at a random position on the sky, essentially it would indicate zero flux because it cannot see the CMB, which happens on larger scales and the interferometer is sensitive to. However, what we can measure is small scale features that are imprinted on the CMB, both in emission and absorption principle. And therefore, we can understand that this absorption line that you can see here that seems to be negative is not really a negative flux, but it's simply an absorption line that goes into the CMB. And by seeing that this absorption line, which is due to ground state transition of water, it goes into absorption against the CMB, this immediately implies that the equivalent brightness temperature of the line is lower than the temperature of the CMB at the redshift where we see the line. And then by looking at the observed frequency of the line, we do see that the redshift of the line corresponds to the redshift of the starburst galaxy itself. And therefore, we know that this essentially is cold water that's associated with the starburst galaxy itself. And therefore, we know what the CMB temperature should be at that redshift. So what I'm showing here is the same thing again, just as a map. So here in green, you can see the continuum emission. And then here in the center is a high resolution measurement at 158 micron of the dust, where you can see that everything is well aligned. What I'm showing you then here is the full absorption line strength. And here I'm showing you the fraction of the absorption line that's against the CMB. So it's just showing the same thing again, which is just the alignment of the absorption component with the starburst galaxy. So what we really seem to see here within the interferometer is kind of a hole in the sky at the frequency of this absorption line. Okay, great. So this is what we measure and what the observations tell us. But the question now is, how can we understand what actually is going on and what else can we learn from having discovered this kind of absorption line against the CMB? So the way that we can imagine this is shown is in this drawing here. So what we're dealing with is this high redshift starburst galaxy, which in red here has the dust continuum emission, and then has also associated this cold water component that causes the absorption, which we then see along our line of sight to the telescope where we do the measurements. And then in the background to this galaxy and water is the cosmic microwave background that we also in principle observe with a telescope, with the caveat that I've already stated. And then at the redshift of the galaxy, we would expect from standard cosmology a CMB temperature of 20 degrees Kelvin. And of course, at present day, the CMB temperature is about 2.7 degrees Kelvin. All right, so how can we use this then, how to better understand what's going on here? So of course, the first thing is, as I mentioned, the CMB acts as a background to the cold water. And our expectation is that the CMB temperature is 20 degrees Kelvin. And therefore, this tells us that if we were to measure zero flux at the frequency of the line, then this zero flux would correspond to a brightness temperature of 20 Kelvin, because what we're doing is a measurement in contrast to the cosmic microwave background. So this is kind of what happens to first order. But then there's, of course, a second thing that happens, because a CMB does not only act as a background source to what we are seeing, but it also acts as a heating source to the water itself, because, of course, a CMB has a black body shaped spectrum. And the photons, therefore, that get sent out by the CMB can, in principle, excite lines. And given the Boltzmann distributions of the photons that we have at the CMB temperature, at the temperature of 20 Kelvin, you can excite the water rotational line ladder. And the key here is that the fundamental transition that we're talking about, that we observe, is the 101 to 110 level here. So the energy difference for this level is just 26.7 Kelvin, and therefore you can excite it with a CMB that's 20 Kelvin. And indeed, this is what happens. So essentially what happens is that that the water absorbs CMB photons to excite this transition here. And what of course then happens is that, because the CMB is black body shaped, is that this excitation happens in a way that the water will be in thermal equilibrium with the cosmic microwave background, and therefore this will result in this enhanced level populations. And at the point where the water is in thermal equilibrium with the CMB, it means that about 77% of the molecules are in the ground state, and then about 20% of the molecules are in this first excited state here. So this is what happens due to the CMB at this temperature. So we get essentially this base level absorption, this base level excitation due to the absorption of CMB photons. However, since what happens here is that the water is simply then in thermal equilibrium with the CMB, what happens is that the excitation temperature is simply 20 degrees Kelvin. And therefore, from this alone, we would not observe any signal, because the water would be just in equilibrium with the CMB. Okay, but why do you observe the signal? We observe a signal because there's a second contribution that's important. And the second contribution then is the starburst continuum emission itself. And we have very precise measurements of the spectral energy distribution of the starburst in the rest frame far infrared. And from this, we can infer that the temperature of the dust in this starburst is 63 degrees Kelvin. And then the starburst continuum emission, of course, also acts as a background to the cold water emission first order. And this is what we can see here, right? So essentially, this yellow band is the continuum emission that is in the background to the water absorption lines. However, the second thing that, of course, and also happens is that the continuum photons from the starburst can also excite the rotational ladder of water in the same bay that the CMB could do so. But the key difference here is that the starburst itself does not have a black body shape, but it rather has a gray body shape, which means that towards shorter wavelength, the optical depth of the dust is increasing. And this, for example, means if you look again at the water ladder here, so we have this ground state transition at 538 microns, but then we have the next excited level at about 108 microns. It means that from the starburst, we have more photons at 108 micron than at 538 microns. So what therefore happens is that we get an excitation of the ground state here due to the starburst continuum, but then we also get an excitation of the next higher state. But because we have more photons available at the shorter wavelengths, the number of molecules that we lift from the 110 state to the 221 state is larger than the number of molecules that we lift from the 101 state to the 110 state due to the starburst continuum. And this simply means that we need this CMB seed population at this level here to essentially fully use up the 108 micron photons. So what therefore happens is that from the effect combined between the CMB and the starburst continuum, we get a net deficit in the 110 level of water molecules compared to the thermal distribution that we had previously just to the CMB. So essentially what therefore happens is that the relative level populations below thermal, and therefore the excitation temperature of this level here goes below the CMB temperature. And what we measure is an excitation temperature of 17.4 degrees Kelvin compared to the 20 degrees Kelvin of the CMB. And this indeed explains why we see an absorption line against the CMB. It's simply because the excitation temperature is lower than the CMB temperature. And this is how we see the absorption signal. All right. So this is to explain the nature of the signal, but how can we then use this to infer further properties, in particular constraint on the CMB temperature itself? So this is, of course, because the measured CMB, the measured temperature contrast depends on several factors. And the first factor, of course, is the CMB temperature itself, as we've seen. But then the second factor is the spectral energy distribution shape of a starburst, which, of course, depends on its dust temperature, dust emissivity, dust optical depth versus wavelength, and the dust mass. It gives us the amount of dust and therefore the total amount of emission that we get. The next thing that, of course, depends on is also the water column density, because the more water molecules you have, the more absorption, of course, you can cause. And then finally, the last factor that depends on is the radius or the size of the dust continuum emission and the filling factor in front of the dust continuum of the absorbing region, because essentially you need to translate from observed brightness temperature to an observed flux, which depends on the size. So these are essentially the factors that go into the strength of the absorption that we measure. And therefore, we can calculate models to see how these different parameters scale with this absorption signal. So what I'm showing here on the left essentially is the column density of water against the radius of the dust continuum emission, here measured and here plus one sigma. And then what's overlaid in white here is the measured strength of the absorption into the CMB, and the dashed line is plus one sigma. And then essentially this gray shaded region here shows you the different model predictions around it. So essentially with this model series, what we can then do is that we can constrain the CMB temperature under the assumptions that all starburst parameters are measured well due to the dust spectral energy distribution and the size measurement that we can then feed into the model. And therefore the only unknown that remains is the CMB temperature at the redshift of 6.3 of the galaxy itself. And that's what's shown in this panel here. So what I'm showing here is the maximum absorption strength that we can get at a given continuum size and filling factor as a function of the CMB temperature. And for orientation, the dashed black line here is the expected value of 20 degrees Kelvin. Then here in the gray shaded, you can see in the continuum. And then kind of these three different lines here in black is for the continuum size that's measured for the galaxy. In red is the continuum size plus one sigma, and in blue is the continuum size plus two sigma and the allowed regions. And what we can see in green here is again the observed plus minus the error bar of the absorption line strength. And what you can see here, for example, if you focus on the red line, is that the minimum filling factor of the water in front of the dust continuum is over 60%. And then that with these 60%, essentially you can explain the expected CMB temperature. But essentially, you get an allowed range for the CMB temperature between about 16 degrees Kelvin and about 30 degrees Kelvin from this measurement. And therefore, we get a measurement that's consistent with lambda CDM at these redshifts. Okay, but now that we have these models, there's one more thing that we can do that's interesting, which is asking the question that if we have a galaxy that has the same intrinsic dust continuum spectral energy distribution as this starburst galaxy, but we place it at a different redshift, we can then ask the question, what would we expect the strength of this effect to be at different redshifts? And again, we sit here at redshift of 6.3, where we measure the absorption signal, and we have now understood essentially where the signal comes from. But what happens if we then place this galaxy at different redshifts, where it's exposed essentially to different CMB temperatures? And then if we do this in a self-consistent way by modifying the CMB temperature and the impact of it on the galaxy SED as well, well, the prediction that we get is that we should see the signal in emission at redshifts up to about 4.5, at which point it goes into absorption. And then we should expect to see almost equal absorption strength as a function of redshift. So essentially an absorption signal that's almost independent of redshift out to redshift of at least 12 or so. And what the different lines indicate is different assumptions. So the black line is a model where we assume that collision excitation is negligible of the water. And then the red and blue lines are extreme cases with high densities and high kinetic temperatures, just to study what the impact of collision excitation would be. And you would see that the effect actually gets weakened if we assume the collision excitation is important. However, we know from the properties of the galaxy that the density and kinetic temperature are nowhere near as high values, and therefore we know that collision excitation is actually not important to explain the behavior of the signal. All right, so therefore we have done the measurement and we can now add it to this plot here, and we get the point here for the measurement where you can see that again, it's consistent with the expectations. Here again, same with the redshift divided out based on the standard expectations. And again, what we get is that the CMB temperature at this redshift of 6.3 is between 16 and 30 degrees Kelvin. And if we take out the redshift dependency that's expected from standard cosmology, this corresponds to 2.2 to 4.1 Kelvin as the allowed range in standard cosmology. All right, but then we can, of course, also take this because we now have this model fit and ask ourselves the question, what are the constraints that we get on the cosmological parameters, in particular the adiabatic index and the dark energy equation of state parameter? And again, for the adiabatic index, we expect a value of 4/3, and we actually measure the value of 1.33 plus minus 0.008 plus. So we see that it's a value that's consistent with standard cosmology. And for the dark energy equation of state parameter, again, we expect a value of minus 1 for a cosmological constant, and we measure a value of minus 1 within the uncertainties. So the measurement that we get from all of these determinations together is consistent with standard cosmology, but essentially now have a new technique to constrain this at higher redshifts and essentially fill in this redshift range here that is currently not populated to get even more precise measurements that we have at the moment. All right, so this is essentially what we have in the paper. And just to wrap up, I want to leave you with this little appetizer on follow-up that we've done since. And this is essentially trying to answer the question if the predictions actually work. And to answer this question, we've measured other dusty massive starburst galaxies with at lower redshifts to see what kind of signal we get. And these are the constraints that we have from this follow-up study here. So again, the behavior that we expect is here that we get emission out to redshift of about 4.5 and then the signal turning into absorption against the CMB. And indeed in this galaxy at about redshift 2.5 here, we see the waterline in emission. Here's a redshift 3 galaxy that also shows the waterline in emission. Here's the galaxy redshift 4.2, where you see the waterline in absorption against the starburst continuum, but not against the CMB as expected. And then here's a galaxy at redshift 4.8, where we indeed also see the absorption into the CMB as expected here. So based on the follow-up measurements, it seems that the picture that we've obtained with these initial models is consistent, and therefore that we should be able to use this technique to gain even more precise constraints in the future. All right, so this is what I had for my presentations, and I hope there are some questions now that I can answer.
Thank you so much, Dominique. Really, really nice talk to me. Is there any comment or question?
Yeah, I may have a question.
Please. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering, water is mostly formed on the dust. And if you want to see water in gas phase, you need to dissolve water. And you won't dissolve it thermally at 30 Kelvin. So it has to be dissolved non-thermally, meaning from cosmic rays or UV photons. Mm-hmm. If you do that, you affect the reverberational population. Mm-hmm. So how does it affect your radiative transfer?
So in principle, as far as we can tell, for this water component, it doesn't. Because if you go back to this picture here, so in principle, we have different components of water actually associated with the starburst galaxy, because we also see higher level water lines in emission that are associated essentially with the galaxy more closely and are excited by the infrared radiation field. And in addition, we have this more diffuse water component that we see in the ground state transition that has this, that's more diffuse. And we know that it's more diffuse because it has this high filling factor in front of the continuum. And as far as we can tell for this component, this additional effects don't matter. And again, in principle, if these effects were matter, it would actually make it more hard to explain the signal. Because for example, if you look at simple, as indicated, at simple collisional excitation, essentially collisional excitation weakens the effects. And in pretty much any effect except just the radiative excitation of the rotation ladder would weaken this effect rather than strengthen the effect. So it would make it harder to explain the effect and would make this constraint more stringent rather than more loose. So it actually it moves in the other direction is essentially the answer.
Yeah, 100, 200, I understand it's it's already desorbed, but 30k is not desorbed. So when you desorb water at 30k, you desorb it, it's already excited rotationally. So I don't know. It'd have been perfect if the molecule was formed in the gas phase only, like a CN. The first, the first molecule for this technique was CN. And,
Yeah, the problem is that CN doesn't have this the excitation structure where we can observe this effect, I think. The
HCN should have.
It's HCN.
I have a curiosity. You were talking about solid water, I mean ice. How strong is our knowledge of the physics, I say spectroscopy of ice to feed some radiative transfer model?
I think in terms of observations, it's not really constrained at all at these redshifts.
Yeah. Okay. But the spectroscopy is very simple.
Yeah, right. Because we're just looking at this, the ground state rotation consciousness.
You don't have rotations.
That you get from the water vapor.
Okay. Even at this very low temperature.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions or comments? The chat. No. Well, another curiosity. At the very beginning of your talk, you showed the you talked about the excitation temperature of the CO to constrain CMB. Can we do the reverse process? I mean, constrain the excitation temperature of CO starting from CMB. Is it reasonable, feasible?
Yeah, I guess in principle you can do that if you've if you fix a CMB and say that it's the only contribution. The problem, of course, here is the collision excitation that you have in the ISM itself, right? I mean, that's the component that's not well constrained. So you can get a base excitation due to the CMB, but you always have this additional collision component. Again, for water, this is not important because the critical densities of the rotation lines are simply much, much higher, many of orders of magnitude higher than for CO. And that's the reason why it doesn't matter for the water, but for CO, right, for the low transitions, the critical density is so low that even in the relatively diffuse ISM, you always get some collisional component that contributes.
I see. Thank you. Well, other comments?
Hi, it's Rafael speaking.
Yeah, please, Rafael.
I have a rough question about the constraints you get on W, which look pretty impressive. What are the hypotheses behind these constraints?
So the only assumption that goes into this is, hang on, I'm going back to the equation.
So what do you think?
That we're using this parameterization here, right? So in principle, what we keep fixed is omega meta zero, and then we use essentially this parameterization for the redshift scaling of the CMB temperature.
Okay.
Yeah. So the assumption that we go into with is that this is applicable. And again, you can go to this paper here to look at the derivation and the assumptions that went into that.
Okay, yeah, I missed the first slide, so okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Rafael. Any other question or comment? Well, if not, thank you, Dominique, again for joining us. And let me advertise the next week's seminar. The speaker will be François Hammer, talking about Gaia ED3 third data release. Accurate orbital parameters for Milky Way dwarfs are most of them in first info. This is next week's seminar. I remind that all the seminars are recorded, and you can simply download the video from the website of the GECO group. Thank you so much, and see you next week. Thank you again, Dominique.
Thanks.